If we identify, we'll talk more about that later. Okay, so anyway, you know, it doesn't matter what your motivation is. If you blow up a children's hospital, that's an atrocity. On the other hand, I think it would be almost impossible to make a moral case against taking out cell phone towers. I mean, you just can't do it. I mean, cell phone towers are so nasty. I mean, they allow the jerk at the next table to yammer on when you're trying to eat, and then cell phone towers kill between 5 and 50 million migratory songbirds every year. And then also they put out those electromagnetic waves, and then they make it so like you have to wear the aluminum beanie, and I always forget like which side goes on the out. It's a problem. Anyway, but it's okay. I can make a moral case against taking out a cell phone tower. Here we go. There's this woman who's driving along late at night, and her car dies. Oh, check out the language. Her car dies. The car doesn't die. The car's not alive. It's like wait until I get to the parking lot, and the car's all going, "We're gonna get you for that one, buddy." The car conks out, and she pulls over the side of the road, and she calls a cop, and she dials 911, and she says, "My car conked out by the side of the road, and can you come start it for me, please?" And the cop says, "Yes." This is a fantasy. Let's go with it. And then so she's sitting there while she's waiting. She turns on the radio. And she hears that this homicidal maniac with a hook on his arm has escaped from the homicidal maniac place. I think it's called the White House. And anyway, so he's escaped from there, and he likes to prey on women whose cars have conked out by the side of the road. And so she's sitting there all nervous, and then the cop shows up, and he knocks on the window, and she makes him show both hands. And then he starts the car for her, and she pulls away. As she pulls away, there's this tug on the car. And when she gets home, she looks on the passenger side, and there's this bloody hook embedded in the passenger side door. Did other people's older siblings terrorize you with that story when you were a kid, too? Anyway, so a cell phone saved her life. You know, we cannot, it would be immoral to take out, but we can just as easily make a moral case in favor of taking out cell phone towers, because the woman's driving along late at night, and she's on this deserted country road, and she calls her mother, and she never calls her mother, and doesn't call her very often. And her mother rushes to the phone, and she picks up the phone, and right as she picks up the phone, she trips, and she breaks her neck. And as she's lying there, she gasps, "Call 911, I broke my neck. And why don't you ever call me?" And then her daughter dials 911, and thank God she has two cell phones. And anyway, so she dials 911, and now she's driving without using her hands, and the car veers off the road, and it runs over three orphans, and then... goes over the last population of an endangered salamander, and she smashes into a tree. And then the last thing she sees before she passes out is this hook gleaming in the moonlight. And the point, insofar as there is one, is that we can make up any sort of hypothetical situation that'll make it so we don't do anything at all. Okay, but that's fine, Derek, but taking down civilization will kill a lot of people. Okay, my next response is, which people are we talking about? Are we talking about marlin people? Are we talking about swordfish people? Are we talking about salmon people? Are we talking about prairie dog people? I think if you ask salmon if people should bring down civilization, they'd be like, "Do it." Ask polar bears, they're like, "Yep." Ask prairie dogs, and they're like, "Yep, yep, yep." But you know what? We don't care about those anyway. What about human people? They're the ones we care about. Well, I think that the rural poor around the world would be better off immediately. I asked the former executive director of Food First, Anuradha Mittal, if the people of India would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow. And she laughed and just said, "Yes, of course." And a couple examples she gave were that there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. The 50,000 villagers in Turkey who are going to be displaced by a dam that was stopped and now has started again would be better off if the global economy disappeared. All the subsistence farmers would be better off. Traditional indigenous people would be better off. Years ago, I interviewed a member of the Tupac Amaristas, the MRTA, and I said, what do you want for the people of Peru? And he said, we want to be able to grow and distribute our own food. We already know how to do that. We merely need to be allowed to do so. And that's it right there. That's the entire struggle. You know, thank you very much. Good night. That's it. And they would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow. Okay, and the rural rich would be better off. Well, they wouldn't be better off. Okay, the rural rich wouldn't be better off, but they'd be okay. They got guns. They'll be fine. The urban poor would be, well, in the long run, the urban poor, and this is not a joke, but in the long run, the urban poor would be better off because the system that's exploiting them would be gone. In the short run, they would be dead. In the short run, the urban poor would be worse off than they are right now. And that's because this system, like any good abusive system, has made us dependent upon the very system that's exploiting us. Any good abuser does that. Because if you don't, those you're exploiting are going to leave. And that's what I think on one hand. But on another hand, I think that might not be the case for the urban poor, because you want to talk about instant land reform? Remove the support from, I mean, if you stopped the flow of weapons and money from the United States to third world elites, there'd be instant land reform. So maybe not. I don't know. Which leaves us only with the urban rich. And would they be better off? No, but fuck them. They're the problem in the first place. That's very nice, Derek, but the fact remains that taking down civilization will kill a lot of people. And I finally came up with an answer. After all those, I finally came up with an answer that I'm really happy with. And that's this, which is, if you've gotten this far in this book, or if you're simply anything other than entirely insensate, we probably agree that civilization is going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't agree with this, we probably have nothing to say to each other. How about David Ortiz this year? We probably also agree that the crash will be messy. God, the fucking socks just collapsed, didn't they? Anyway, we probably also agree that the crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. If you agree with this, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who'll be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, that civilization's going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan, they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or, if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people to protest and to chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All this can look like supporting traditional local knowledge. It can look like starting rooftop gardens. It can look like planting local varieties of medicinal herbs. And it can look like teaching people how to sing. The truth is that, although I do not believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do, however, have a responsibility to support the people doing that. Likewise, those people growing medicinal plants in preparation for the end of civilization do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who've chosen that work. In fact, they have a responsibility to support them. They especially have a responsibility to not report them to the cops. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so fucked up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love. Do what you can. Do what best serves your land base. We need it all. That doesn't mean that everybody taking out dams and everybody working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goals. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large-scale and coordinated. The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places, simultaneously if possible. By contrast, the work of renewal must be local. I have a new catchphrase: dismantle globally, renew locally. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they'll thrive. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. That doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas, that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what'll work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. I've been thinking a lot again about the cell phone tower behind Safeway, and I see now how these different approaches manifest in this one small place. The cell phone tower needs to come down. It's contiguous on two sides with abandoned parking lots. Those lots need to come up. Gardens can bloom in their place. We can even do our work side by side. 10th premise of the book. The culture as a whole and most of its members are insane. The culture is driven by a death urge and urge to destroy life. I don't need to talk about everybody being insane, do I? Go on. Oh, but I don't know if this happens to you. Sometimes the vision of Angelina Jolie will rise up and appear before me. It makes me happy. It used to scare me back when she was with Billy Bob. They were bad for each other. Each one had a vial of the other's blood around their neck. And do you know where she had his name tattooed? Oh my God, I'll bet she was wishing his name was Ed. Speaking of genitals, did you know that Nicole Kidman does not like to wear underwear? I read that in the newspaper, so it must be true. Does anybody know what's the indigenous name for this place? So Northern New England was Wabanaki?
Yeah, and that, like, the Abenaki Alliance, so the Abenaki people, it's the same
room. But does anybody know what's... Thank you. And does anybody know what's the name for this place? I think it's insane that I can tell you that... Oh, gosh... that the Red Sox have collapsed, or, I'm sorry? Africa? This place right here? The name of this place is Africa? What, okay, whose land is this?
Penobscot.
And what I'm asking is, what is their name for this place? Okay, so what I think is insane is that I know what is on Angelina Jolie's genitals and what is not on Nicole Kidman's, which I can guarantee will never affect my own personal life. And I don't know the names. Oh, first off, and it took me 2 years of living where I do to learn that there was a massacre of about 250 Indians about 2 miles from where I live at a place called Yontaket. And then if you go over here to a place called Achalet, there was another massacre about a mile away. And then about a mile over here, there was a massacre at a place called Ahuanquet. And it took me a couple years to learn that. And it's insane that I can tell you statistics of various baseball players, that the Seattle Mariners picked up Ben Broussard in midseason, which I think was actually quite a good deal. Talk about a collapse. Man, the Mariners just nosedived. And they were already terrible. It's insane that I can tell you about that, but that I can't tell you 10 species of edible plants and fungi within 100 yards of my home. That's crazy, literally, in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. I mean, okay, let's try. Huckleberry, blackberry, salal, thimbleberry, salmonberry. I'm doing okay. Chantrell, Huckleberry. Oh, and then those big red mushrooms with the white dots. You know, I was thinking, if I eat one of those, I can take out a dam all by myself. I can take out a dam with one finger. One of the reasons that we don't defend the places that we'd live is that we don't live there. We live with Brad and Angelina and with Tom and Katie and Suri and with Pedro and with David. We don't live where we live. Anyway, the 11th premise of the book. Okay, what I'd like to do is I want to talk about the 11th premise. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do in a second. I'll just do it. How's that? The 11th premise of the book. And this might be the most important one. That from the beginning, this culture, civilization, has been a culture of occupation. And the government has been a government of occupation. What does a government of occupation do? It moves in, it extracts, it facilitates the extraction of resources and facilitates the maximization of production and doesn't really care about communities. What does the U.S. government do? Moves in, facilitates the extraction of resources, blah, blah, blah. I want to read something about that. If Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we all do? Oh, we'd watch television, by gum. What would we all do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power. And what would we do if they then instituted laws allowing them to put a significant portion, say one-third, of all Jewish males from the ages of 18 and 35 into concentration camps? What if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams? With citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist or following Mussolini corporate party? What if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Substitute the word African-American for Jewish and ask yourself the same questions. Now, would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies, made rivers unfit for swimming, and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore? Can you imagine people used to actually drink from rivers? How quaint is that? What if they did this because, hell, I can't finish that sentence, because no matter how I try, I can't come up with a motivation good enough even for fascists to irradiate and intoxify the landscape and water supplies. If fascists systematically deforested the continent, would you join an underground army of resistance, head to the forest, and from there to the boardrooms and the halls of the Reichstag to pick off the occupying deforesters, and most especially those who give them their marching orders? And what would we all do if instead of it being, you know, the government to which we pledged allegiance, what would we do if it were space aliens who would come down from, that's where they come from, if aliens came down from outer space and they started to systematically vacuum the oceans, started to systematically just deforest the planet, you know, and they put dioxin in every mother's breast milk, and they were changing the actual climate, and they were melting the ice caps, and they took 90% of the large fish in the oceans. What would we do if they were space aliens who were doing this? I mean, I know exactly what we would do. We would put on our camo outfits. We would grab our AK-47s. We would have... Wrong audience. So, like, am I the only person here with an AK-47? You know, I shared the stage with Ward Churchill a while back, and... He was in the audience when I was talking, and I asked the same question. Am I the only person here with an AK-47? Just silence from the audience, and then I hear this voice go, nope. Or what would we do if instead of it being, you know, space aliens or something, what if it was the Iraqis who had come in? You know, the Iraqis were so close to invading. They were, like, this close. If the Iraqis had invaded and they were putting up 2 million dams in the United States, what would we do? We would know what to do. Okay. So maybe your sense of kin and your sense of skin doesn't extend to the natural world. Maybe you don't yet love the land where you live enough that you'll fight for it. But what if the fascists toxify not only the landscape, but the bodies of those you love? What if their actions put dozens of carcinogens into the flesh of your lover, children, mother, brother, sister, father? How many people here have had someone you love die of cancer? It's about 80%. Cancer, of course, is a disease of civilization caused in great measure by the toxification of the total environment. Would you fight back? What if the fascists toxify your own body? Would you still cling to the illusion their edicts carry more weight than that brought to bear by their secret and not-so-secret pleas? Would you work for this regime? Would you teach others its virtues? Or would you fight back? If you won't fight back when they toxify your own body, when precisely will you fight back? Give me, and more importantly yourself, a specific threshold at which you finally take a stand. If you can or won't give the threshold, why not? None of these questions are rhetorical. The questions are real. They are, at this point, some of the most important questions there are. What I'd like to do now is very quickly talk about, just read one, two more premises, then talk about one premise, and then read two things, and then bash hope, and then read two things. That's what I'm going to do. Okay. Premise number 12. There are no rich people in the world, and there are no poor people. They're just people. The rich may have lots of pieces of paper that many pretend are worth something, and the poor may not. The rich claim they own land, and the poor are often denied the right to make the same claim. A primary purpose of the police is to enforce the delusions of those with lots of pieces of paper. Those without the papers generally buy into these delusions almost as quickly and completely as those with. These delusions carry with them extreme consequences in the real world. So, you know, people say that Weyerhaeuser or Plum Creek own a lot of land. They don't. They have in their possession pieces of paper that we all agree mean that they own land. We all just agree that's a shared. We all share that same assumption. I mean, it's like there's a bunch of cars out there in the parking lot. They don't actually belong to anyone. And I can say this because, of course, my truck is on the other side of the continent. But there's just cars, and then we all agree that this car belongs to you, this car belongs to you. And I want to be really clear. When I say that Plum Creek doesn't actually own any land, I'm, A, not saying that that shared delusion doesn't have effects in the real world, because of course it does. I'm also not saying that there is no such thing as ownership. The land where I live belongs to the Talua, and the reason it belongs to the Talua is because they lived there for 12,500 years, and their blood is mixed with the soil forever. And they have participated in that predator-prey reciprocal relationship for so long that they own the land and the land owns them. I also want to be clear that I'm not saying that we need to throw out every cultural convention. What I'm saying is that with the world at stake, it might not be a bad idea to start examining the cultural conventions we have and decide which ones we want to honor and which ones we don't want to honor. 13th premise of the book. Those in power rule by force, and the sooner we break ourselves of illusions to the contrary, the sooner we can at least begin to make reasonable decisions about whether, when, or how we're going to resist. Next premise. We'll go to the 15th premise very quickly. This is another one of my favorite ones. Love does not imply pacifism. I love this one. I get this all the time. It's like, Derek, you know, if you loved enough, you just need to love the CEOs. If you love the CEOs enough, then, well, something good will happen. And you're just hurting yourself by being angry at them, by hating them. And if you really loved enough, you could never even consider doing any act of violence to anyone. I don't think that love implies pacifism, and I think Mother Grizzly Bears will back me up on this one. I grew up in the country, and I have in my life been attacked by mother horses, cows, chickens, mice, geese, hummingbirds, hawks, eagles, spiders, dogs, cats, who thought I was attacking their babies. If a mother mouse will attack someone 6,000 times her size, what the hell's wrong with us? One of the reasons I wrote this book is because when I would do talks about fighting back, the response by the audience was really predictable, and they fell into separate camps. Like a lot of sort of mainstream peace and social justice activists, a lot of them and a lot of sort of mainstream environmentalists would put up what I've taken to calling Gandhi shields. And that means they would say Martin Luther King, Dalai Lama, Gandhi again and again as quickly as they could to keep all evil thoughts at bay. And then grassroots environmentalists would do the same thing, but then they would come up to me after the talk and they would say, thank you for bringing this up. And then the other group I found the most interesting, which was like family farmers, survivors of domestic violence, a lot of the very poor, a lot of people of color, prisoners, a lot of American Indians, a lot of radical environmentalists would look at me like, tell us something we don't know. Let's go, bro. And I thought about that distinction for a long time, and I finally realized that the difference is for all those latter groups, violence isn't some capital V thing. When you've experienced it in your own body, not always, but oftentimes, it simply becomes a part of life. It doesn't mean you participate in it. It means it's just part of life, and you deal with it. It's not capital V. You don't reify it. You don't deify it. You don't make it into something it's not. It's a big deal, and it's a very small deal. It's part of life. Every bear knows that. Every frog knows it. Every giant water bug knows it. Anybody who's ever been pinched by a giant water bug knows it. And then, oh, I got to say this. I just have to do this. Sorry. Sorry I'm going on so long, but I just have to do this. So part of the reason I wrote this book, it was originally going to be, it's two books. Part of the reason, it was originally going to be this like 100-page pamphlet that was going to be, I was going to take a lot of the sort of standard arguments that are thrown out by pacifists, because a lot of times when I would do this, then the pacifists would just get so pissed off, and they would all throw out the same arguments all the time that I'm sure every one of us have heard, and we could all like do the little sing-along with the bouncing ball thing if we had them written down. And I just wanted to sort of deal with those all at once with this pamphlet. So next time I ask the same goddamn thing about you can't use the master's tool to dismantle the master's house, I could just hear, look at the pamphlet. So I just want to take care of a couple of those right now. One of them is you can't use the master's tool to dismantle the master's house. First off, anybody who ever says that has never read the essay from which it came, because the essay had nothing to do with pacifism. It had to do with the inclusion of a wide variety of voices. And but what's actually more important, and I mean, I love Audre Lorde, she's great, but I'll tell you this, she never worked construction, because it's a terrible metaphor, because it doesn't matter whose fucking tools you use. You can use the master's tools as man of the master's house, you can use my tools, you can use your tools, you can use anybody's tools. And there's a deeper problem too, which is that this presumes that violence is one of the master's tools, that those in power own violence. And look, those in power have tried to convince us they own the land. They tried to convince us they own the water. They tried to convince us they own the trees, because how could the Forest Service put out timber sales if they didn't own the trees? They tried to convince us they own genetic material. And I'll be goddamned if I'm going to let them say they own violence too. They don't own it. And once again, I think Mother Grizzly Bear is going to back me up on this one. Those in power do not own violence. It's not one of their tools. Sure, they use it, but they also use discourse. Does that mean we can't use discourse? They own the means of industrial religion production. Does that mean that we can't use spirituality? They own the means of industrial education. Does that mean we can't use education? Can we not use anything they use? We may as well just give up. The next one, there's another one is... I love this one too. They say, you know, you're so dualistic, Derek. You know, you talk about us and them, and When you talk about them, you're reinforcing that dualism, and you're reinforcing that there is a them and an us, and that's part of the problem. The whole dualisms need to be eradicated. And so whenever somebody says that to me, I always say, ah, so what you're saying is dualism bad, non-dualism good. Checkmate. Another one is... I guess the last one I'll do, and then I'll bash hope for a minute, is another one. Oh, gosh, I can't remember the others. But there's another one that is really big, which is, oh, I know one. Oh, God, I'm going to do two. This one's so embarrassing. I can't even believe this. This is so, so embarrassing. I can't even say it. I mean, this is like admitting to be a compulsive masturbator, which I'm not. Really? Okay, how many people here have a copy of A Language Older Than Words? Okay, how many people also have a straight razor? Okay, what I'd like for you to do when you get home is take the chapter Violence Revisited and take the razor and cut those pages out. Crumple them up and throw them away because they're so embarrassing. Because in that chapter, oh, I'd rather talk about compulsive masturbation. In that chapter, I actually said, if you fight back, you run the risk of becoming like they are. Okay, so does this mean that the woman who kills the man who's attempting to rape her runs the risk of becoming a rapist? Does this mean that the tiger who kills a zookeeper runs the risk of becoming a zookeeper? Does this mean that Tecumseh ran the risk of becoming like the people who are trying to steal his land? It just doesn't make any sense. And I can't believe I actually wrote that. And then the other one I want to do is that they say violence never accomplishes anything. And it's like, oh, that's just bullshit. That's fucking bullshit. It's goddamn fucking bullshit. It's George Bush goddamn fucking bullshit. So what that means is all the Africans jumped on the slave ships and they came over and then they just worked in the cotton fields, in the rice fields, in the sugar fields for the hell of it. And that means all the American Indians said, hey, want some land? Here you go. There's a great line by Robin Morgan. She says that anywhere, any woman, anywhere in the world can be walking alone late at night, and if she hears footsteps on the road behind her, she has reason to be afraid. She calls that the democracy of fear. Don't fucking tell me that violence doesn't accomplish anything. It has radically changed the behavior of half of the population of the human species. Violence accomplishes a hell of a lot. Oh, wait a second. This culture is based on violence, and violence doesn't accomplish anything, which means the culture doesn't exist. We're done. Okay, so what I'd like to do now... Oh, shoot, I forgot about this earlier. Sorry, can I go on about one other thing for a minute and then talk about hope? When I was talking about the reasons why, you know, the responses to the woman who said that if you bring down civilization that will kill a lot of people, the other response, which I think is the most important one, which I forgot earlier, which is that through the crash, I can guarantee that almost 100% of the horrors are going to come because those whose lifestyles are already killing the planet attempt to maintain those lifestyles. They have the power to make it a softer landing, and they will choose to not do that. It's like if somebody blew the dams on the Colorado, or if they collapsed on their own, and the Colorado River once again reached the ocean, then I can guarantee if the capitalist press is still around, they will bray as one that people are thirsty. It's like right now, we hear all the time, the world's running out of water, the world's running out of water, people are dying of thirst because the world's running out of water. Bullshit. People are not dying of thirst because the world's running out of water. They're dying of thirst because the water is being stolen. 90% of the water used by human beings is used for agriculture and industry. So if the dams were to collapse, I wouldn't want to hear one word of complaint so long as there still existed a single irrigated alfalfa field in Arizona, a single citrus orchard, a single golf course. Human beings in cities, metropolitan human beings, use the same amount of water as are used by metropolitan golf courses. I wouldn't want to hear one word of complaint so long as there existed a single golf course, a single swimming pool, so long as Las Vegas still existed. It's like One of the reasons they want to raise the Shasta Dam is because, as Senator Dianne Feinstein said, it is Californians' God-given right to water their lawns. You cannot argue with that, except with explosives. Okay, so anyway, I want to bash Hope for a couple minutes and then read two very short things. A few years ago, a friend of mine called, and she was in tears. She's an environmental activist in Northern California, works on pesticide issues. She was just sobbing, and she said, you know, this work is so hard, so hard. It breaks my heart. It's killing me. I said, yeah, it'll do that. And she said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. She said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. She said, unless it's stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is, unless it's stopped. I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? I thought a moment, and then I said the thing I knew all along was the best thing I could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I knew that was the best thing I could say is because about 13 or 14 years ago now, I was undergoing a similar collapse where I was just bursting into sobs many times a week over the death of the salmon, the death of bull trout, the death of Selkirk caribou, Kootenai sturgeon. And a lot of my environmentalist friends were saying, you know, take some time off, Derek. The problems will still be there when you come back. And I knew that that wasn't what I needed to do. I knew that if you're not going to cry about the death of the salmon, what do tears mean? You know, when are you going to cry if you're not going to cry about that? And I knew I just had to keep pushing. And then one day I called this friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, an Okanagan Indian writer and activist. And I said, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. It's so hard. And she said, yeah, it'll break your heart. It'll do that. And I said, dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. And I said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. And I said, unless it's stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is, unless it's stopped. I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could possibly say is because it normalized my despair. And it let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. And it let me know that sorrow is just sorrow and that pain is just pain. And it's not so much the sorrow or even the pain that hurts as it is my response, as it is my resistance to it. And it let me know that I could feel all those things and it wouldn't kill me. You know, there's this idea that if you really acknowledge how bad things are, you have to run around being miserable all the time. I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we are really, really fucked. And that life is really, really good. And that we're so fucked. And life is just so, so good. And we're really fucked. And life's really good. I got this email from somebody a while back in which she asked me how my anger at the dominant culture affected my sex life. And I was so tempted to write back, you know, that's a question to which you will never know the answer. I realized, though, that the question was based on the idea that anger's a shotgun. And that just because I'm angry at the dominant culture, that I'm angry at my friends. But the truth is, I'm angry at the things that make me angry, and I'm not angry at the things that don't make me angry. And I respect the things I respect, and I don't respect the things I don't respect. And I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart, I'm so full of rage, and I'm so full of hate, and I'm so full of love, and I'm so full of joy, and I'm so full of satisfaction and dissatisfaction and contentment and discontent. And we're allowed to feel more than one thing at a time. But I realized something even more powerful than that I could feel all those things and it wouldn't kill me, which is that I could feel all those things and it would kill me. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. Not through threats, not through violence, not through promises. You can still sing and you can still dance and you can still make love and you can still fight like hell. but they can't touch you. The smartest thing the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Would you rather get an ID card, or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? You want to move to a ghetto, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? You want to get on a cattle car, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way. Zygmunt Bauman has this great line: rational people will go quietly, meekly into a gas chamber if only you allow them to believe it's a bathroom. I would say rational people go quietly, meekly to the end of the world as long as you allow them to think that buying recycled light or buying low-energy light bulbs will save the day. Once again, at every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. But I'll tell you something very, very important, which is the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. No, listen. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Keep that in mind over the next 10 years. One of the reasons that my mother stayed with my father was because there weren't battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s. But another reason that my mother stayed with my father is because of the false hope that he would change. False hopes bind us to unlivable situations and they blind us to real possibilities. What are the false hopes that keep us tied to the system? Does anybody really think that if we just ask nicely that Plum Creek or Weyerhaeuser will stop deforesting? Does anybody think that if we just ask nicely that Monsanto will stop Monsantoing? Does anybody really think that if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, things will be okay? Oh, I got to tell you this. I did a talk a while back. Some Democrats brought me someplace to do a talk, and they had a dinner for me beforehand. And my mom came along because it was close to home. And at the dinner, I said, "So what are you going to talk about tonight?" I said, "I'm going to talk about taking down civilization." And it was just silence. And then later on, one of them is saying, "You know, if we can just take back the White House and if we can just take over both houses of Congress, then things will be okay." And I'm thinking, yeah, I wouldn't mind taking over both houses of Congress, but I don't think I mean the same thing you do. And that's a joke, Mr. Gonzalez. Put away the electrodes. Anyway, so you know, they're saying if we, the Democrats, can just take over the White House, things will be okay. And my mom says, you know, the Democrats are just as controlled by corporations as the Republicans. And it was so funny. It was just like my mom had just hiked up a cheek and farted. Because there's just silence for a second, and then noses wrinkle. And then somebody finally says, "Could you please pass the hummus? It's really delicious." Anyway, so what are the false hopes that tie us, you know? I mean, does anybody really think that shorter showers are going to save the day? You know, does anybody really think? Okay, what it will take for salmon to survive. Oh, here's another thing that's really important, is that one of the reasons that we don't win is because we don't want to win. We don't even know what does it mean to win. We don't know what we want. You know, one of the reasons that we keep losing is because the other side knows exactly what they want. They want every fucking tree, and they want it now. And what do we want? Do we want smaller clear cuts, kinder clear cuts, gentler clear cuts? What do we want? I know what I want. I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has less dioxin every year than the year before in every mother's breast milk. I want to live in a world that is not being destroyed. And I will do whatever it takes to get there. I will do whatever it takes to get there. There is only one measure by which we're going to be judged by the people who come after. They're not going to give a shit about whether we voted Democrat, Republican, or didn't vote at all, or voted for Ralph Nader, or voted for Emma Goldman. They're not going to give a shit. They're going to give a shit about whether they can drink the water, whether they can breathe the air, whether they can live on the land. They're not going to care about whether we recycled. They're not going to care about whether we were violent or nonviolent. They're not going to care about how hard we tried. What they're going to care about is whether the land will support them. I feel so embarrassed saying this. Everything comes from the land. Without the land, you have nothing. We can fantasize all we want about some groovy eco-socialist utopia with free love for everybody. It doesn't fucking matter if you can't breathe, if you can't drink the water. I have a new slogan, which is protect your land base. You can't have sex without it. Everything comes from the land. Anyway, so what are the false hopes that keep us tied to the system? And what I'm thinking is, it's like what it will take for salmon to survive are six things. What they need are six things. Dams to be removed, industrial logging to stop, industrial fishing to stop, industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff, global warming to stop, which means the industrial economy to stop, and for the oceans not to be murdered. Those are all technically doable tasks. It only becomes difficult cognitively when we say, how can we save salmon without removing dams? Then it becomes cognitively really challenging because you can't do it. That's a false hope, to think that we can have salmon and dams, to think that we can have air conditioning and no global warming. They're tied. Everybody knows this. Okay, but the problems aren't just false hopes, but it's hope itself. Because I was doing a talk a couple years ago, and I was just bashing hope, and somebody in the audience shouted out, "What's hope? What is your definition of hope?" I was like, "Oh my God, you know, I've been bashing hope for years. I have no idea what I'm talking about." And so I asked them to define hope, and somebody in the audience came up with a great definition. Actually, the whole audience together came up with a great definition, which is hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. And this is how we use it in everyday language. I don't say, "I hope that I eat something tomorrow. I'm just going to do it." Or, you know, "I know that men are supposed to be afraid of commitment, but I'm going to commit to you here in public that I'm going to eat tomorrow. I don't hope I eat tomorrow. I'm simply going to do it." On the other hand, when I get on an airplane tomorrow, I hope it doesn't crash. Because once I'm in the air, I have no agency. And I mean, think about this with a little kid. Okay, a little kid says to the mother says, "Clean your room." The little kid says, "I hope it gets done." Non-starter. The mother says, "Yeah, I hope it gets done too." Anyway, so when I say, "I hope that coho salmon survive," what I'm saying is I have no agency. I do not hope that coho salmon survive. I will do whatever it takes to make sure the dominant culture does not drive them extinct. If they don't like how they're being treated and they want to go away, I will say goodbye and I will miss them. But if they do not want to go extinct, I will not allow the dominant culture to drive them extinct. I will do whatever it takes. I do not hope that coho salmon survive. When speaking of the apocalypse, it is customary to end on a happy note. And so I'm going to read two very short sections, and then we'll be done. The first one is, the first one I didn't write. The first one was written by a stream near my home. I was trying to write what it's like to be a river. And I tried for several days, and I realized that that's really stupid. Why should I try to write what it's like to be a river when I can simply go ask one? That'd be like me trying to write what it's like to be a woman when I can just ask you. And so I went down and I asked the stream, "What is it like to be you?" And I've since realized that that is the fundamental question in any relationship. What is it like to be you? Romantic relationships, relationship with trees, anybody. Romantic relationships with trees. What is it like to be you? And I don't think we ask that question often enough. You think I'm kidding about romantic relationships with trees. If only you knew. Anyway, I asked the stream, and the stream had been waiting a long time for someone to ask because it gave me the answer right away, 5 seconds, literally. I ran inside, wrote it down as quickly as I could, didn't even edit it, and I got to tell you, the stream is a way better writer than I am. Pretend you're a river. Pretend you're the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that nothing separates water and air. You're the rain who falls in sheets, explodes onto the ground to leave pocks and puddles. You're the ground who receives this water, soaking it up, taking it in, carrying it deep inside. You are the cracks and fissures where the waters accumulate, flow, fall to join more water and more, in pools and rivers who move slowly through cavities, crevices, pores. You are the sounds and silence of water seeping or staying still. You're the meeting of wet and dry, the union of liquid and solid, where solids dissolve and liquids solidify. You're the pressure who pushes water through seams. You're the rushing water who bubbles from the earth. You're a tiny pool between rocks. You overflow, find your way to join others who, like you, are moving, moving. You're the air at the surface of the water, the joining of substantial and insubstantial, the union of under and over, weight and not weight. You're the riffle, the rapid, the tiny waterfall that turns water to air and air to water. You're the mist who settles on the soil. You're the plants who drink the mist, and you're the sun who warms and feeds them. You're the fish who feed on insects, who feed on plants, who feed on soils, who feed on fish. You're the fish who become soils, who become plants, who become insects, who become fish, who flow down the river. You are the river who joins other rivers to become a new river who's all the rivers and something else. You are the river. You do not stop at the banks where liquid turns to solid. You reach into the sky and into the soil. Water moves through rocks, comes up to form pools far from the fast flow where the rivers move together, seeps down to join still waters deep below the surface, waters who sleep and wake and sleep and mingle with the stones who are the river too. You are the river, who's married to the mountains you've known since they were young, who've given themselves to you as you've given yourself to them. You're the canyons you nestle into, each year deeper than the year before. You are the forests who give you their fallen trees, and the meadows who flood and feed, and who feed you back their fruits and fine insects who fly to your surface to be taken in by the fish who, with their own bodies, again feed the meadows. You are the river who feeds the ocean, who feels the tides pushing and pulling against your mouth, the waves mixing fresh and salt. You are that intermingling. That's who you are. That's who you've always been. You are the river. You've lived with volcanoes and glaciers. You've been dammed by lava and ice. You've carried log jams so large and so old they grow their own forests with you running beneath. You've lived through droughts and floods. You are the river. You miss the salmon, you miss the sturgeon, you miss the ocean, you miss the meadows, you miss the forests, you miss the beavers and otters and grizzly bears. You miss the human beings. You're the river. You want them back. You want to feel the tickling of the sturgeon, the thrusting of the salmon. You want to carry food and soil to the ocean. You want to cover the meadows as you used to, and you want to give yourself to them, and you want them to give themselves to you as you've done forever and as they have too. Now, pretend you're a forest. You're the bark of trees and the hairy moss who hangs from them. You're the duff who becomes soil, who becomes trees, who becomes seeds, who becomes squirrels, who become owls, who become slugs, who become shrews, who become soil. You are the trees who cannot live without the fungi, who cannot live without the voles, who cannot live without the trees. You're the fire who cannot live without the trees, who cannot live without the woodpeckers, who cannot live without the beetles, who cannot live without the fire. You are the wind who speaks to the trees and the trees who speak to the wind. You're the birds who sing and the birds who do not. You're the salamanders, the ferns, the millipedes, the bumblebees who sleep on flowers waiting for the morning to warm you up so you can eat and fly on home. You too have lived through drought and flood, hot and cold. And you too miss the salmon. You miss the owls, the grizzly bears. You miss the rivers. You miss the human beings. You want them all back. You need them back or you will die. And finally, I want to talk about a tradition of the Cheyenne dog soldiers. It's called the picket pin and stake. Before a battle, a few of the bravest Cheyenne dog soldiers will be chosen to wear sashes of tan skins called dog ropes. Attached to each dog rope was a picket pin, normally used to tether horses. During battle, the pin would be driven into the ground as a mark of resolve. Once the pin was driven, the dog soldier would remain staked to that piece of ground, even to his death. Retreat was no longer an option. The pin could only be removed when everyone was again safe or when another dog soldier relieved him of his duty. It is time. I have driven my picket pin. I am staked out and willing to give in no more. Where will you drive your own picket stake? Where will you choose to make your stand? Give me a threshold, a specific point at which you finally stop running, at which you finally fight back. Stand with me. Stand and fight. I am one. We would be two. Two more might join and we would be four. When four more join, we will be eight. and we will be 8 people fighting whom others will join, and then more people and more. Stand and fight. The questions before each of us now are, what are your gifts and how can you use them in the service of your land base? What can you do? What does your land base most need from you? How can you achieve it? What do you want to do? And right now, perhaps the most important of all, what are you willing to do? People ask me all the time, so Derek, what do you want us to do with all this information, all this analysis? And I always say, don't listen to me. I don't know how to live sustainably. I don't know how to live here. What's the nearest river? What's the nearest river? St. George. If you want to know how to live sustainably, ask the St. George River. It knows how to live here. It's lived here for a very long time. If you want to know how to live sustainably, ask the mountains, ask the forests, ask the trees, ask the bay, ask the ocean. If you ask them, they will tell you what they need. And then really the only question is, once again, are you willing to do it? Thank you very much. Okay.